Welcome once again to our series, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages. Our resident scholars, Ron Eldred, who is teacher at John Paul II Catholic High School, both in Scripture and in Apologetics. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick's here at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the streets. Ron, welcome once again. We've been going through a little history. We worked through the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, on our last sessions together, and now we're up to the Renaissance, the 15th and the 16th century, which was certainly a colorful period in history that preceded the Protestant Reformation. So tell us a little bit about the Renaissance or the Renaissance.
Well, the term derives from the French Renaissance, which means rebirth or renewal or something like that. Occurring roughly during the 15th and 16th centuries, the Renaissance, as we would say in English, began in Italy and later spread to the rest of Western Europe. The renewal was of classical Greek and Roman culture that had largely lay dormant during the Dark Ages that we discussed during our last session. The movement was stimulated by the fall of Constantinople, which we referred to also in our last session, the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire. This happened in the 15th century. And also by the closing of the university by the Ottoman Turks, who had conquered Constantinople. They were, of course, Muslims. This forced many Greek scholars to migrate to Italy, bringing with them hundreds of copies of Greek and Roman literature and law, many of which had been lost to the West for centuries. Now, the Irish and the Benedictine monasteries, and there were other monasteries as well, the Cluny monasteries and several others that we talked about last week, and they also, of course, had manuscripts. They had kept manuscripts that that the barbarians hadn't destroyed, and they copied them and what have you. But during this period at the beginning of the Renaissance, many, many, maybe hundreds, even thousands of manuscripts were brought in of ancient literature that had been lost to the European Middle Ages. Although the Renaissance saw development in many areas of intellectual activities, it is perhaps best known for its artistic aspect and the contribution of such men as Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo, who have inspired the term the Renaissance men or man. When one thinks of the Renaissance, they usually think of humanism.
Now, say a word about that, because it's a little confusing. Two kinds of humanism. Humanism, not ecumenism, but
yes.
Humanism.
Well, it's an ethical philosophy that helps a person determine right from wrong by using reason. Whatever variety, humanism stresses the worth and dignity of the individual. And I think there are good humanisms, such as Christian humanism, and maybe the word bad is not exactly the right word, bad humanisms, such as secular humanism. There are good aspects of secular humanism, but I might add the good in, I think, secular humanism comes from its Christian roots. Just that it's forgotten those. The humanism of the Renaissance tended to be of the more secular variety, and Christian humanism finds its ultimate justification in its belief in human worth and dignity from divine revelation, of course. Human beings being created, you know, in God's image and likeness and those kind of ideas. The incarnation, you know, God himself taking on human flesh, becoming a human being, enhancing the dignity of human beings. Whereas Renaissance or secular humanism found its justification for belief in human worth and dignity solely, this is what's important, solely in human reason.
Without any kind of revelation,
yes,
without any reference to the Bible.
That's correct. Secular humanists of all varieties reject the validity of any supernatural sanction for human behavior. They base their system of morality on some form of universal morality based on the fact that all human beings share a common nature and a common destiny.
Isn't that what Pope Benedict XVI has been stressing, such as the United Nations talk and the like, that the natural law is something that we all can stand together on.
It's a common denominator.
Okay, well, how about didn't Renaissance humanism affect everything? Cultural, politics, society, literary, art, aspects in the life of Europe at that time?
Yes, it did. The standards of ancient government, art, architecture, literature, philosophy, other social and cultural areas of inquiry became the standards for Renaissance men and women. Classical truth, beauty, justice became the standards they used to judge these qualities during this period, the Renaissance period. Ancient Greek and Roman art, literature, architecture, these were the standards of beauty and truth and justice and what have you. The Renaissance is believed to have begun in Florence, Italy, in the last decades of the 14th century, but accelerated by the scholars who had fled Constantinople with Greek and Latin texts after the Muslim conquest that I mentioned a while ago.
This was the Ottoman Turks?
Yes, the Ottoman Turks. They revived the study of Greek, Latin, and Greek, which resulted in the revival of the study of science and philosophy and art and poetry of classical antiquity. One source has said, quote, "The revival was based on interpretations of Roman and Greek texts, whose emphasis upon art and the senses marked a great change from the contemplation of the biblical values of humility, introspection, and meekness. Beauty was held to represent a deep inner virtue and value, an essential element in the path towards God."
Pope Benedict XVI has made similar comments about that, how beauty is an attraction and a magnetism towards God, who is all beautiful.
Well, I need to say that here that the Renaissance humanism was not entirely secular by any means. It still possessed a strong religious element. The source that I was quoting a while ago goes on to say, quote, "Renaissance humanists believed that the liberal arts, that is music, art, grammar, rhetoric, oratory, history, and poetry, using classical text and the studies of all of the above, should be practiced by all levels of wealth, that is all social classes. They also approved, not just the upper classes and the nobility, they also approved of self, human worth, and individual dignity," end of quote. Which, of course, as we know, are Christian values. Whatever was the good in the Renaissance derived from Christianity, as I suggested a while ago. Christian humanists of the period included the Dutch theologian Erasmus, the English scholar and Saint Thomas More, and the Italian poet Francisco Petrarch. Secular humanists of the day include the French writer François Rabelais and the Italian scholar Giovanni Pico della Mirandola.
Okay, now you mentioned Erasmus in this Renaissance rebirth in the culture starting in Florence. Wasn't he one of the great biblical scholars of the period?
Oh, yes, he was. Desiderius Erasmus. He was a Dutch Catholic priest known as the, quote, "the prince of the humanist," end of quote. Needless to say, he was a religious humanist. He was a Catholic priest. He had become an early 16th century expert in ancient Greek and Latin texts. In writing in fine Latin, he prepared important new Latin and Greek editions of the New Testament. He also wrote other books, such as The Praise of Folly, and The Handbook of a Christian Knight. These are fairly famous books, of course, that Erasmus wrote, of a secular nature, but with a lot of religious, content. Erasmus had gotten exclusive four-year publishing printing rights for his New Testament Greek translation with annotations, that is, footnotes, from the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian, and also from Pope Leo X. In 1516, His text eventually became known as the Textus Receptus and went through several editions. Luther had used the second edition when making his German translation of the Bible. It's believed that the third edition of 1522 was probably used by William Tyndale for the first English New Testament in 1526 and was the basis for the 1550 Geneva Bible. Those are both, of course, Protestant Bibles. And the 1611 King James Version, or what is more technically called or properly called the Authorized Version of 1611 of King James I of England. It's a Protestant version, of course,
The famous Protestant version.
Yes.
In English.
Yes. And one of the most classical English translations. It's really Shakespearean English, Elizabethan English. I think much, much better than the Dewey Rhymes translation, which of course was translated about the same time that we talked about earlier in this series.
It was more a literal translation.
Yes.
But a Catholic translation.
Yes.
France.
Yes, it's a Catholic translation.
Yeah, in France.
The fourth and the next to last edition, published in 1527, contained parallel columns of Greek, the Latin Vulgate, and his Latin text. And this work remained the standard Greek translation for many years afterwards. I think if I recall right, for maybe 100 years or more, maybe a couple of hundred years. Erasmus also wrote a popular version of the New Testament in Latin entitled Paraphrases of the New Testament, which was translated into many other languages. I suspect it was a kind of a harmonization of the Gospels.
Erasmus had such an influence, and they were spending a little extra time on him, because he was even questioned perhaps about his loyalty to the church or to the faith, and his support of Protestantism in this very difficult time when Protestantism was beginning to rise. What can you say about that?
Well, I think when assessing this matter, I think that we have to keep in mind the times in which he lived. Many developments had occurred the previous two centuries to discredit the church in the minds of many, especially intellectuals such as Erasmus. And for these reasons, the visible institutional church, this is very important, the visible institutional church was at low ebb, its reputation was, during the Renaissance period, and was much in need of reform, as it had done many times in the past. Without going into detail, I have in mind the Babylonian captivity of the papacy to Avignon, France, the Great Schism. I've heard it pronounced all three different ways. I think schism is probably correct. That followed when up to three men were claiming the papacy. The Black Death, a plague that wiped out at least a third of Europe. Corruption and worldliness in all ranks of the church. The rise of national states and several other factors were contributing factors to the church losing a lot of its reputation, becoming discredited in the minds of many, including even Erasmus himself to some extent. Well, to make a long and complex story short, Erasmus lived during a time that many people, for various reasons, were becoming critical of various Christian beliefs and practices. And some of the critics were starting to reject the authority of the Pope and to develop entirely new theological systems not in accord with the Catholic faith. And Erasmus, he tried to steer a middle and impartial course between Protestants like Martin Luther and the more fervent and loyal Catholics, which of course earned him enmity from both sides.
Okay.
He was a reformer. He wasn't a rebel.
Okay. He was honest in his criticisms of the church, by and large.
I think so.
And churchmen particularly.
In fact, he was a friend. He was a personal friend of Thomas More, you know, the great famous Saint Thomas More. In fact, he went to England and spent some time with Thomas More.
Okay.
Even while criticizing some practices of the church at the time, he never wavered in his intellectual commitment to the church and its doctrines. Although Luther had thought highly of him as a scholar and enlisted his support for the reform of the church, he became disappointed, then disillusioned with him because he wouldn't accept his more radical innovations. During the so-called Catholic Counter-Reformation that followed the Protestant Reformation, the Church placed many of his books on the Index of Forbidden Books, many of Erasmus's books, because it was argued that he had not been strong enough in his criticism of Luther, that he had not seen the dangers of a vernacular Bible, that is, a Bible, of course, written in the language of the people, and for, quote, dabbling in dangerous scriptural criticism that weakened the Church arguments against Arianism and other doctrines, end of quote. Erasmus's reputation has fluctuated considerably among the various Protestant denominations, and although he has been held in high esteem by some, others have been extremely critical of him for not supporting Luther on many points important to them in their battles against Catholicism.
Okay, so Erasmus is a great translator from Greek, had influence on many of those who translated into vernaculars.
Like for at least a century, maybe a couple of centuries, his Greek translation was the standard that scholars would use in their
work. And really an outstanding translation.
Well, I've heard that, but on the other hand, David Dungan, whom we've quoted many times, points out in the chapter a lot of weaknesses in it, and that scripture scholars eventually began to see a lot of these weaknesses in it. And he was in too big a hurry because he had a deadline, my understanding is, a publishing deadline, and that caused him to hasten too much and get a little sloppy at times, apparently. But
certainly a towering person in biblical interpretation history.
There's no question of that, yes.
Okay, well, can you give us a brief summary of some of the main accomplishments in biblical scholarship during the Renaissance in the 15th, 16th century, roughly?
Certainly. A man by the name of John Sandys Wunsch, he's a biblical scholar at the University of Victoria. I have one of his books is really quite a good book on this whole subject. He provides us with a nice compact summary of the accomplishments in biblical scholarship of the period that we've been discussing, the Renaissance. He says, number one, Renaissance humanism represented the careful study of language and the examination of the various meanings and usages of words. As part of this, humanists were interested in collecting manuscripts and in using new technology of printing to make biblical text of a standard form readily available.
Help me. When did Gutenberg invent the printing press?
Well, it was during the 16th century sometime, if I recall right.
Okay. It was before Luther was just bringing out his German translation.
Yes. There were... printing existed before Gutenberg, but I understand that the printing... they would have to carve out blocks.
Oh.
And these blocks were very time-consuming and very expensive to do. It was movable type that really speeded up the whole process, where you could take lots of letters of the alphabet, pick out the ones you want, and move it, and then when you got through with it, you could put something else in there. It was a movable type really speeded up the whole process. And I think that's what Gutenberg was more... had to help to invent was this idea of the movable type.
And the printing press of the movable type then became a great means of distributing vernacular copies of the Bible.
Oh, yes. In fact, there was just almost an exponential growth during this period.
Well, you're talking about a little summary of the Renaissance, or the Renaissance 15th, 16th in biblical scholarship.
We're giving John Sandys Wunsch's summary here. The second one, in particular, for the Christian church, this meant a better knowledge of Greek as well as a recovery from Jewish teachers of Hebrew and Aramaic. Furthermore, medieval Jewish scholarly exegesis on the difficulties in the Hebrew Bible had great influence on the Christian scholars during this period. And then finally, the study of language revealed that the precise meaning of words can change with time. And Valla showed how the Bible's meaning could be falsified by reading biblical words as if they had the same meaning in the 15th century as they did in the 1st century. So these are some of the things that they were able to some advances they were able to make during this period, some positive things that they were able to do during this period of time.
Well, this is even a great problem today in translations, because words do change rather rapidly, even in English. We have God is terrible, or awful, meaning awesome, filled with awe by anybody who comes in contact with living God. We have the word gay, which has completely changed its meaning in English in the past 25 years.
Yeah, happy and gay.
Happy and gay.
That used to be a very common saying.
Right. So there are all kind of words that change, and that's why translations have to change.
Well, Sandys Wunsch concludes by saying that by the end of the 16th century, the careful examination of text was having unexpected results. For example, Andreas Macias argued that the Pentateuch was not the work of a single author. Remember, we spent a whole session looking at the documentary thesis of Wellhausen and Graf, although, of course, there are some criticisms of that, too, which we examined at the time.
And didn't the church finally conclude that the five books of Moses, or the Torah, were basically written by Moses?
Certainly, if not written, inspired.
Okay.
Greatly inspired. You know, for centuries it was held, and probably Augustine himself probably held this view, that Moses, you know, wrote the first five books of the Bible. And that view held sway pretty much until the time of the Renaissance. And really, after the Renaissance, we'll talk about a man by the name of Ramirez later on. I think he was, if I recall right, was one of the first ones to question the Moses authorship, or at least the complete authorship.
Personal authorship.
Yes, authorship. And, but nonetheless, Catholic Church still holds that the primary inspiration for the Pentateuch is Moses.
Okay.
And there was a Joseph Scaliger during this time. He recognized that some problems of biblical chronology were possibly insoluble.
Well, during the Renaissance, Protestant Reformation scholars introduce a new approach to biblical scholarship?
Yes, this is where you really begin to see a departure for the first time since the time of St. Augustine. The Protestant Reformation was a movement in Europe that began with Martin Luther's initial attempts to reform the Catholic Church in the early 16th century, but in short order ended up as a full-scale revolt against the Church. And it ended with the Peace of Westphalia in 1648. The main change introduced by Protestant biblical scholars was a shift from allegorical interpretation of the Bible to more literal ones. You might recall St. Augustine had placed a great deal of heavy emphasis upon spiritual interpretations or allegorical interpretations. This is one of the ways they were able to smooth over a lot of the inconsistencies and contradictions. If there was an apparent contradiction or inconsistency, well, there isn't really, because we're just not interpreting it correctly. So maybe it's not intended to be this particular passage or this particular verse or whatever. It's not intended that it be a literal translation, that there must be some underlying, some hidden meaning. And so that's what we have to ferret out.
So his famous dictum, the New Testament was hidden in the Old Testament, and the Old Testament was revealed in the New Testament.
That's correct.
Using quite a bit of not literal, but allegorical interpretation.
Well, the Bible was extremely important for Protestants because they had rejected tradition as a source of revelation. We spent a session talking about those two, Scripture. God's revelation is found in two sources, you know, the Holy Bible and in sacred tradition. But the Martin Luther and the Protestants rejected tradition and kept the Bible only, or the Bible alone, or sola scriptura in Latin. Because of sola scriptura, the Bible becomes the sole source of revelation, so having accurate translations from the original languages is very important to them.
Sure.
Having rejected the Latin Vulgate, They chose
of St. Jerome.
Of St. Jerome. They chose instead to return exclusively to the Greek and Hebrew text. Keep in mind that the Vulgate, of course, was primarily a Catholic translation of the Bible, and perhaps they didn't trust that very much, or some aspects of it. So the idea was to get back to the original Greek and Hebrew text as much as possible to make their translations. But it wasn't so much the translations that they made from the original sources that created confusion for biblical scholarship. It was their commentaries on the text that created the problem, because they ignored 1,500 years of tradition of the church and the analogy of faith. Most of the commentaries, of course, had been written, and all the commentaries had been written by church fathers, the doctors of the church. These were, of course, Catholics. And most of them, many of them, contained certain doctrinal statements where the doctrines of the church were tied in, you know, with verses and chapters and books of the Bible. In other words, their commentaries placed a Protestant interpretation of the Bible, which we have said in a couple of earlier sessions, that Catholics should be very wary of any exclusively Protestant translations of the Bible for this reason, because they're going to have their own doctrinal orientation toward the Scripture, their own translation, their own interpretation. However, in all fairness, I must say that many of the early Protestant interpretations of Scripture were not that much different from those of the churches. Even Martin Luther wasn't, in some ways, he had not completely rejected all Catholicism.
I know he kept his devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary, which was from his Catholic roots.
And he continued some version of the Eucharist. He did away with the sacrificial idea, of course, in the Eucharist, but he kept up an idea of a real presence. But his real presence was not a transformation, a transubstantiation of the substances from the bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. It was, it still remained bread and wine, but Christ was present in the species of that was still bread and wine, of course. And this is called consubstantiation in theology. But not only that, but he maintained a confession for some period of time after that, after the Reformation.
Yeah, the sacrament of penance, or confession.
Yes.
A regular person-to-person confession to a priest or to a minister. Well, Ron, once again, our time is running out. I suppose we just maybe need to end there. Give a quick little summary of where we've been, talking about how interpretation came from the early fathers down to the Renaissance. Well, that's what we've been talking about. I think our time is out. So to our listeners, may God bless you always and in all ways. Thank you for being with us.